Again, we're very fortunate in our speaker tonight. I've always, as I just commented, felt rather sheepish around cancer researchers when I light up a cigarette, but I'm relieved to see that our speaker tonight also smokes, in spite of the fact that he is in cancer research, or perhaps because he is in cancer research, and is pretty well aware of the statistics, the odds, and what have you. Our speaker is Dr. Barnett Rosenberg, truly a distinguished member of the faculty, one of whom we're all very proud. He's been at MSU since 1961. I beat you by 3 years. And was the founder and is now professor of the Department of Biophysics. And the train of his research is, I think, one of the most fascinating things to read imaginable. I don't understand it, but I delight in reading it, because it is a classic illustration of the way that research grows out of research and goes on into different and new directions. I'll read you a brief description. As I say, I don't understand it. Maybe in the question period somebody can ask Dr. Rosenberg. Initially, his major areas of research interest were in the solid-state electrical phenomenon of inorganic and organic crystalline substances, with particular emphasis on photoelectric phenomenon. I can follow it that far. This later shifted to the application of these photoelectric phenomena in organic substances to biological systems, such as vision and photosynthesis. I can still follow it. A new area, and here's where he loses me, developed from this was the long-range movement of electrons in proteins and other biological macromolecules. Currently, his research interest is in the field of application of metal coordination complexes in cancer chemotherapy and in the application of thermodynamic principles to aging processes in various animals. And if we're lucky, he'll reverse the trend in time for all of this. And with that, I will give you Dr. Rosenberg.
Well, thank you, Dr. Anderson. It's a delight to be able to come down here and talk about our work. As you might imagine, we're rather pleased and enthusiastic about what is happening with it lately. And it's always a pleasure to bring good news to an audience. The title of the lecture was listed as Some Battles Won in the War Against Cancer. And I think that most of you are quite aware that a decade ago, it became official United States policy to declare a war against cancer, or a crusade against cancer. And we've dedicated now approximately $1 billion a year in recent years to this particular battle. If you read the newspapers and the journals, however, you begin to get a sense of deja vu. I've been here before. It sounds like Vietnam all over again. We're going to see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're going to turn the corner any moment. But so far, the impression is given that there's been no change in the death rate from cancer in the world. That, I am happy to say, is probably wrong, but with certain restrictions. There are some cancers that we apparently now can establish quite hefty cure rates on, and others that still remain resistant to any methodology that we have tried so far. Our basic understanding of what a cancer is, what causes a cell to become a cancer cell, is still too elementary for us to get any advantage in learning something about how to treat it. So if we were to depend upon having the knowledge first of what causes a cell to become a cancer, we probably will have to wait another few decades before that is complete. However, I think that the sense that my fellow researchers, and in particular the clinicians who are oncologists, the specialists in cancer, indicates that we now can shift from what was called guarded optimism in the past few years to less guarded optimism. Probably within the next 10 years to 20 years, it is fairly safe to suggest that most cancers will be in the curable column. That doesn't mean all, but most. And fortunately, we at Michigan State have had a ringside seat at the new developments, the optimistic developments, with regard to the treatment of certain types of cancers, at least, and have made some contributions to moving a few of those cancers into the curable column. What I'd like to tell you about is the story of how our involvement emerged and what we have found and what is going on with the discoveries that we made in our basic research laboratory. Primarily, perhaps, as a technique of how research is done, as Dave had suggested, and also to indicate that there are a variety of methods of doing research. There is no one technique. Everybody practically has developed their own unique aspects. But there's one aspect of research that shows up very nicely in our particular project, and I'd like to emphasize this one. How does one go about finding a cure for cancer? Well, it appears that looking for it is the wrong way. That almost invariably, the major advances that have occurred in the treatment of cancer have been accidental discoveries, where people were not looking for that in particular, but they found something significant which they could capitalize on for the treatment of cancer. And our case is certainly a classic example of this phenomenon. It used to be called, well, it still is in many people's minds, called serendipity. However, I'd like to suggest that there's something even more subtle about it. In about the 1950s, there was an article in the Sunday New York Times magazine section, which some of you may have caught. It was a new philosophic approach called resistentialism. The basic tenet of this was that nature is actively against us. Of course, it was in response to Sartre, whose popularity was growing very rapidly at the time. And it was a very clever idea. The philosophy itself is a very attractive one to scientists because it's probably the only philosophy I know that is subject to an experimental test. And almost any one of you can do this test. And this is one of the standard tests for such a philosophic idea. You take a number of swatches of rugs and lay them on the floor in series of increasing expense. Then you take a piece of toast and you put some grape jelly onto the toast on one side. And you stand over each swatch and you toss the toast into the air. And you see where it lands on whether grape jelly down or grape jelly up. And you do this statistically for each piece of rug. And what you find is that, statistically speaking, the number of times it falls grape jelly down increases with the cost of the rug. Now, from this philosophy, one can derive two corollaries. One is that you will find what you're not looking for. Serendipity is a specialty in that category. The other one is you will not find what you are looking for. And that's what happened to us. Both corollaries have been verified by our experience. Now, what was our experience? We did not start out, as I say, looking for a cure or a treatment of cancer. We started out to do a simple, basic experiment in what I would call biophysics, or the application of physical understanding to biologic processes. I was trained as a physicist, and after my PhD, I started to become interested in this new emerging field of biophysics. And one of the first things I did was to open up a book on biology. I never did take a course in biology in school, simply because I couldn't pith a frog. But one of the things I saw amazed me, and I was rather intrigued by it, and that's shown on the first slide. Can you turn the light on, please? The slides. All right, what it is probably familiar to most of you. It's a schematic picture of a cell in the process of dividing, which is standard and goes on in all of our bodies. I think that could stand just a bit more focusing. All right, what you have is a cell that has now established an orientation with two poles in the nucleus of the cell, or around the nucleus of the cell, which then dissolves. Then you go on to form what's called the spindle fiber, and the genes that give you the genetic information which codes the cell now begin to have replicated and are splitting into two batches, each side getting a complete set of genes. And so you then have the genetic material split into the two sections of the cell, and it goes on to form a sort of an indentation, a cross wall, and finally the cell separates into two daughter cells, each one with a full complement of the nucleic acid, the DNA. What intrigued me was this picture here, because to a physicist, that suggests something quite different. Namely, the kind of a picture one would get if you took a bar magnet, put a sheet of paper over it, and sprinkled it with iron filings. It's a dipole field, as we call it in physics. And this could be a negative pole of a magnet and the positive pole, or if you go to electricity, this could be a negative charge and a positive charge, and these would be the lines of force around those two charges. I speculated on this for a while and then read some more, and I found out that others had indeed been struck by that parallelism between the picture of a cell in division and the picture of a dipole field in physics. And nobody had ever done any experiments to test it. Well, we decided to test it. What we looked at it was this way, how we looked at it. If this is indeed a dipole, then if you come along with an electromagnetic field of the right frequency, it will just resonate, just like an antenna for your radio. It just resonates at the right frequency, and it picks up energy from this field. Well, if it does pick up energy, then you're pouring energy into the cell. If you're pouring energy into the cell, perhaps it might do something of damage to the cell. You can see already that there was some idea that we might want to selectively damage certain kinds of cells in the back of our minds. Obviously, its application to cancer was there, but we never seriously considered it in the early stages. But the basic idea then was to tickle this with the right frequency and see if you could affect the ability of the cell to divide. How do you do this? Well, we did a very simple system. We took a chamber, a little glass chamber, and we pumped into it a nutrient fluid which will keep the cells alive. We then put a little overflow tube on it so it kept the volume of the chamber constant. And therefore, after a while, there was a standard volume in the chamber, and now we inoculate that with the cells we want to grow. And after a period of time, it comes to a steady level, a constant number, because as the cells are growing, some of them are being washed out. This is called a continuous culture apparatus, and the cells are floating free in the material. To test it, we used a simple bacterium called E. coli, which is the standard gut bacterium we all have. The system was designed initially for this particular kind of bacterial work, but we were going to use it for mammalian cells, but we started out to test it with bacterial cells. Now, how do we apply the electric field? What we did was to simply take two platinum electrodes and dip that into the cell, into the chamber where the bacterial cells were growing. And then we hooked it up to a Scott amplifier, a standard high fidelity amplifier. And we just simply fed a signal in of the right frequency from an audio oscillator. And so we were able to control the frequency and the power level with the standard amplifier. And now we simply watched as what happened to the cells as we turned the electric field on. Well, what happened was is that the chamber was in danger of going aseptic. The bacteria were disappearing. And we didn't know what was going on until we took a look at what was happening to the bacterium themselves, and they emerged in that overflow tube. The next picture shows a scanning electron microscope picture of what these bacterium look like. They're rods. They're about 5 millionths of an inch long and about 1 millionth of an inch in diameter. And they normally grow to twice their length, and then a cross wall forms, a cross septum, and they divide into two cells. This is the process of bacterial growth or division, where the cells simply divide into two daughter cells. When we looked at the bacterium after we had turned the electric field on, what we saw was neither a subtle nor sophisticated effect, But at the same magnification, those bacterium looked like this, a bowl of macaroni. We were not looking for something that was trivial. It was a very obvious, blatant effect, and we knew that the electric field caused it, because when we turned the electric field off, eventually all the bacteria returned back to their normal sizes. And so we thought we had found the process we were looking for, namely the electric field control of the cell division. Because what's obviously happening here is that these enormous filaments means that the bacterium are growing and continuing to grow, but they're not dividing. So we found a way of stopping cell division in bacterial cells by this technique. And it was the electric field effect, presumably. Well, with this as an assay technique, then, we started to look for what the mechanism might be. And after a few experiments, it became quite obvious to us that it really had nothing to do with the electric fields itself acting on the bacterium, but the electric fields was causing a small amount of the platinum, a presumably inert material, to go into solution in a few parts per million as a very special chemical. And it took us 3 years of detective work to find out what that chemical was, and that chemical is the one that we are now using to treat cancer patients. It's called cisplatin now. Its structure is shown, overshot the mark. Its structure is shown here in the upper left-hand corner. It has a structure somewhat like a square sheet of paper with a platinum atom in the center. And then on one side, there are two ammonia molecules, the standard ammonia that you smell when you wash your floors. And then on the other side, two chloride molecules, the same as in sodium chloride. A very simple, small molecule, but with a very fascinating history. This new drug for treatment of cancer was discovered in 1845. The problem was is that there were two chemicals with the same number of atoms around it that could be made, but they had different properties. And the two were discovered within a few years of each other. It wasn't until the turn of the century that some fellow, Werner, in Germany, got the very clever idea that the differences between these two chemicals are how these four are disposed in the different corners, because one can make two different structures. You can either put the two chlorides on the same side, or you can put them diametrically opposite each other. The opposite ones, of course, are called the trans compounds, and when they're on the same side, they're the cis compound. And so on the basis of this understanding of the structure and the proof that came after that, we were able to establish the basis for coordination chemistry. And so this simple little molecule has a very noble history in terms of its chemical applications and understanding. But nobody knew that it had any interesting biology. And that was what we have added to the development, simply by showing that it had that beautiful effect upon the bacteria. Well, we began to pursue this study because it was a rather unique effect. No other chemical we knew of caused that particular kind of effects upon the bacterium. All right? We had a simple assay system, namely just looking at the bacterium under a microscope and then doing various things to the chemicals and seeing what effects it has. And it turned out that there were some rather intriguing effects. For example, we found that if you take other kinds of platinum salts that are not this neutral type of a molecule, where you have a 2+ charge on the platinum and you have two negative charges on the chlorine canceling each other, and this have no charges, so entirely this is a neutral molecule. But if you took some which were salts, like sodium chloride type salts, these were beautiful bactericides. And this was an area we thought was very exciting because it worked against both gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria, which generally most antibiotics don't work against. However, as we pursued this further and the newer properties emerged, the use of it as a treatment for bacterial infections became less significant, and we pushed it aside into a cul-de-sac, and unfortunately we never got back to it to be able to understand what the mechanism might be and whether it might be usable. By the way, I should point out that in proof of that second corollary that I mentioned, that we finally did do the test I suggested of trying the effect of the electric fields and doing it properly without platinum electrodes, which confused the whole issue, and of course it didn't work. But what we did find after starting out looking for a physical technique for controlling cell division was a chemical technique for blocking cell division, and of course that was sufficient for us to want to pursue it. All right, so we found that they were bactericides. There were a lot of other bacterial properties that we studied, all under the sponsorship of grants from the National Institutes of Health. We came to a time, however, when the grant was running out, we had to put in for a renewal. And we wanted something rather spectacular in order to guarantee that the grant would be renewed. And so we finally made the intuitive jump of testing this on tumor cells. And what we did was to find a person on campus who had mice with tumors growing in them and a technique for transplanting them. And we learned from him, and my associate, Mrs. Van Kamp, was responsible for most of the that kind of work. And what you do there is you take a solid cancer that's growing in an animal and you cut it up into little fragments, little pieces of about 10 milligrams each, and then you implant it under the armpit of a virgin mouse. A virgin, that is, in the sense that it's never seen the tumor before. And now what you do is you allow it to establish itself for one day. That's day zero. On day one, you then inject the drug that you want to test after you've established what level will kill the animals, what level is acceptable to the animals, and so forth. All right, we did that experiment, and we found that after day eight, when the controls had very large tumors, the treated animals had no tumors. And at first, of course, we thought that we had done something foolish and killed the tumor or done something before we had done anything to the animals with it. We weren't very sure of ourselves, so we repeated it at least a dozen times. And each time it repeated beautifully. Controls worked beautifully, and the treated animals showed no growth. We then became convinced that indeed there was some anti-tumor activity in the platinum drug. We tested about four different complexes about that time, and they were all quite active, but they were all fairly similar. In fact, these are the four, in terms of their structures. Well, when we reached that point, we then contacted a friend of mine at the National Cancer Institute and suggested to him that we had a new class of chemicals which had never been looked at before, and they might be interested in trying them. And they invited me down to give a lecture about the work, and I did so, of course. And I noticed that there was a very cool atmosphere prevailing in the lecture hall when I gave the talk, primarily because the medical doctors looked up at me and said, that quizzical look, are you suggesting we give heavy metal poisons to humans? And I said, yes, if it's going to be turning out in the tests to be usable. And the reason that they ask such a question is an interesting example of faddism in science. Because you go back in history, you find that the first real solid chemotherapy, the specific chemotherapy for a disease discovered in the early 1900s by Paul Ehrlich, was Salvarzam 606, the specific against syphilis. It was an arsenical compound. And here it was, a metal compound that was being used to treat a specific disease successfully. Why didn't it continue to develop in the use of metal compounds in medicine? Well, it didn't, simply because about the same time organic chemistry began to grow, biochemistry began to emerge from the organic, the discovery of the sulfonamides in the 1930s, and then later on the discovery of the antibiotics, sort of pushed the interest in metals aside so that we rarely ever use any metal complexes or chemicals in medicine today. And in fact, the standard textbook on pharmacology, which all medical doctors must read and memorize practically, it's about that thick, Goodman and Gilman, was has a chapter in it on heavy metals. The second paragraph of that chapter says that the only reason for a chapter on heavy metals in a textbook of modern pharmacology is to lay the final nails in the coffin in the use of metals in medicine. And that's the attitude of all medical doctors today. Unfortunately, the revised edition hasn't come out yet. I'm hoping that they will change that. So, what we have then is that the Cancer Institute was a little bit unhappy about the idea of testing metal complexes. After all, they had tested approximately 300,000 compounds by that time looking for anti-cancer activity. Out of those large numbers, only about a dozen were metal complexes, and none of them had any activity. This gives you a numerical example of the extreme prejudice of the medical doctors against the use of metals. I left the four compounds there, and since the law requires that they test any chemicals submitted by a, quote, authentic source, and I presume to them I was an authentic source, they did do the tests on a different tumor system than we had done. And about 2 months later, they called me and asked if I would be interested in submitting a grant proposal to them to expand this work, since it had turned out that it is quite active against their standard screening tumor as well. And I assure you, I submitted one with alacrity, and they've been supporting the work ever since. But while they were doing that, we did something quite different. And this was the first indication we had that we should not let go of it. And by the way, this is the only picture I'll show you of cancer, so those of you who are queasy about it, don't worry. Here is that solid sarcoma 180 growing, and by day 8, you can see that it's a fairly large size solid cancer, weighing about 1 gram in a 20 gram mouse. It's a substantial part of the mouse. By about day 20, it's grown to about 3 grams in size, and it invariably kills the animal sometime between days 20 and 35. Now, what we did was we changed the protocols that the Cancer Institute standardly uses, and we tested the compound against these kinds of cancers, advanced cancers. And here is a single example taken from another set of such animals, which were treated with a single injection of the cisplatin drug. And we gave the injection into the intraperitoneal cavity, the gut of the animal. About 4 days later, you begin to see a necrosis or blackness forming in the central core of the tumor. And indeed, the animal starts to groom it out, or we have seen it actually fall out on the floor of the cage. The wound heals, and the animal goes on to live a normal life expectancy, dying of normal causes. And up to about 11 months later, which is the latest that we had tested it, they completely reject any attempt to reimplant this tumor into the animal. They've already developed an immunologic reaction against it. Now, this intrigued us for one simple reason. No other anti-cancer drug known today, even, can do this. And we can do it with 100% ease. Every one of the animals is cured. So we knew we had something that was more than just of passing interest. The Cancer Institute also, of course, later on, over the years, after doing lots of studies against different cancer systems in animals, began to push one of them, one of our drugs, up to clinical trials. And usually these are done by what they call the three-phase system. Phase one system is after they have done tests on dogs and monkeys, which are done just to see what kind of effects the drug has on the normal organs of the body, what kind of side effects we can anticipate, the so-called pharmacology and toxicology studies. They then have established a low dose level at which they can safely put into human beings. That's what they come out of the animal tests with, plus some ideas to what the side effects are that they could anticipate when they go into human beings. And then in about 1972, clinical trials were started with phase one patients. Now, phase one patients mean that the patient is non-responsive to all standard modalities of treatment. They have failed. They are also in a very poor physiologic status by that time because of the metastatic cancers that usually are throughout their bodies. Their immune system is very much depressed because of all the previous drugs that they have taken or X-ray radiation therapy. And so they're rather poor candidates for giving any significant information. But they are indeed very brave souls because they are required to give informed consent, which means that they're told by the doctor that we want to use you in essence as an experimental animal. We don't know if this drug is going to do anything for you at all, but we may learn something from it which will help others. And these people do volunteer for this treatment. We did find in those phase one clinical studies that there were a number of interesting responses in two tumors particularly, testicular cancers in men and ovarian cancers in women. And there were two different laboratories that were clinics rather, that were involved in these two different studies. And the results were sufficient to stimulate a significant amount of further activity in the phase two trials, where now you can give this as a first drug to patients rather than a last drug. And of course, you invariably get better responses when you do so. And we were not disappointed. Those responses were very good. And we were able to get a number of patients into complete remissions. However, those remissions were of short duration. And this is really, truly one of the frustrating things about cancer chemotherapy. You're able to make masses of tumor disappear. And I mean masses, pounds of tumors have disappeared. And then after a period of time, they start to come back again, and they're resistant to the drug that made them disappear in the first place. A very frustrating phenomenon. Nevertheless, we were able to get some into remission by this process, but we also learned some serious side effects that bothered the doctors enormously, and that was that it damaged the kidney. And the reason why it bothered them was because most of the oncologists and the drugs that they have used do not come across this kind of a kidney damage, and therefore they didn't know how to handle it and what to do for the patients. And so this sort of threw everything into a static situation for a period of about 2 years. In 1973, at our first major meeting in Oxford University in England, the clinician's attitude could be summed up by the expression that one doctor from Texas specified, "This drug is too good to drop, but too hot to use." It wasn't until about 1975 that a group of doctors at Sloan Kettering Institute, and particularly one young man, Dr. Esteban Svitkovich, came up with a very simple pharmacologic trick that removed the kidney toxicity. And it was quite trivial. He tested it on dogs first, it worked, and he then went on to humans with it. Now, he said this: all right, we have a platinum, which is a heavy metal, and it's causing damage to the kidneys. Well, we know heavy metal salts cause damage to kidneys, and we know that you can treat this by simply putting a lot of liquids, water, through the patient and giving him a diuretic agent, which makes them urinate extensively. Well, let's try that with the platinum. Well, his reasoning was wrong, because the type of damage that the platinum does is quite different than the damage that's done by lead or mercury. But nevertheless, the experiment turned out right. It's a classic medical experiment. Wrong reasons, right results. And so they started to hydrate the patients. Just simply put lots of fluids through them, drink a lot, even put IV drips in it and so forth. And they found that they were able to increase the dose by a factor of 3 and still get quite excellent anti-cancer activity. That is, it did not wash the drug out of the system, but it protected the kidney. Well, now we moved into the high dose therapy, and that started to give us even more significant results. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, NCI, National Cancer Institute, another study was going on, which also led to an even more interesting development. The success that we're having today in the treatment of cancer, for those which we can treat, comes about primarily because we use a combination of drugs, not a single drug. It is rare to find any cancer where a single drug is better than a combination. The studies that were done under the National Cancer Institute were to test the platinum drug in combination with almost all other anti-cancer drugs in animals. And it was found that it worked either additive in terms of their anti-cancer activity or synergistically, which means an improved result that you could not anticipate from just the two drugs separately. It turns out that for some still unknown reason, that platinum drug is additive or synergistic with every known method of treatment of cancer. And that includes radiation therapy and, most recently, hyperthermia, heating the patient to a slightly elevated fevers. And so we have the basis set for an enhanced availability of the platinum drug in treatment of almost all of the standard tumors. What you do is you take advantage of the fact that the clinicians have, over the years, very slowly, very laboriously evolved a complex methodology, a protocol, or whatever you want to call it, of drugs for a given type of cancer, which gives you the maximal response for that cancer. And what we're suggesting, or had been suggested earlier, was to take the platinum and then just add it to these other combinations. And it should improve the results. And indeed, that's exactly what has happened. There are a number of human cancers now where we're beginning to get quite substantial value to the patient in the treatment. Let me tell you the story of one of them in a little detail, and then some of the others a bit more sketchily. The pride of place must go to testicular cancer. We've already seen from what I said earlier that the platinum drug was quite active by itself against the testicular cancer, but it did not produce long-term remissions. However, there had been a therapy that was evolved at MD Anderson Hospital of a treatment of testicular cancer using two other drugs, bleomycin and vinblastine, which was able to put about 40% of the patients into complete remission. But they only lasted so for about 6 months. And then the tumor came back with a vengeance, and the patients inevitably died. And I should point out that it's not a trivial cancer, despite the fact that only about 0.5% of all cancer cases are this type of cancer. It is the major cancer in young men between the ages of 15 and 35. Now, when this material on the platinum came out about its activity, it was then added to this combination therapy by two different groups in two different, slightly different ways. One was done at University of Indiana by Larry Einhorn. Another one was done at the Sloan Kettering Institute in New York City. But they're beginning to converge now on a common treatment. But what happened was that about 60 to 70% of the patients went into complete remission. And these were, by the way, advanced metastatic cancers where it had spread from the testicles up into the lung area, and you can see it on the lung X-ray pictures. And they were surprised and happy to see that these tumors zoomed down and disappeared within a few weeks of the therapy. The question then became of how long would they remain in remission? It turns out, very long time, to the point now of where the doctors can now say these patients are cured. With recent advances now, and the latest reports we've seen, 85% of the patients with advanced metastatic testicular cancers will be put into complete remission and remain so for at least 5 years or more, so that we can now say that it meets the standard criteria for a cure. Now, let me explain what I mean by a cure. You can use the word cure as a verb or a noun. To cure someone is to do something which gets rid of the disease that's threatening them. And occasionally, we have seen such cures in cancer patients. But on the rare occasion, 1%, 0.5% or so of different types of cancer. This is not medically satisfying. What we mean by the noun sense of a cure is one that all patients respond, not just 10 or 20% of them, but all patients. Two, that the response be a complete response, the disappearance of all symptoms of the disease. They are now in a no evidence of disease status. The third criteria is that they remain in that status for a significantly long time, so that based upon prior experience, we can be fairly certain that they will not relapse. The tumor will not reappear. Under those three criteria, the clinicians now state that testicular cancer is curable. We lose 15% of the patients, not because they didn't respond, but because in the process of those tumor cells metastasizing, where little cells break off from the main tumor and spread through the body, they spread up into the abdomen, into the lung, and some of them get into the brain. When they get into the brain, that is a sanctuary against drugs. Very few drugs penetrate the blood-brain barrier. That is, you inject the drug into the blood, and it's carried to the brain, but the brain has a barrier that does not allow the drug to penetrate into the brain cells. And the cisplatin drug, apparently, for most types of cancer, is not able to penetrate the blood-brain barrier. Therefore, we lose 15% of the patients because of the metastases to the brain. The rest of their bodies are clean. We have wiped out all of the cancer in the rest of their bodies, but they die of metastatic brain cancer from that type of cancer. This has stimulated a significant amount of activity in many places around the world looking for other modifications of the molecule which will enable it to penetrate the blood-brain barrier. And so far, nothing has appeared successful. However, it turns out that in some types of brain cancers, not metastatic cancers to the brain, but cancers which start in the brain, like gliomas, that there is indeed some activity of the platinum drug against it. Apparently what happens in those cases is that where the tumor is growing, it breaks down that blood-brain barrier, and now the drug can get in to that kind of tumor, and it does have an effect. This is now being studied extensively in a number of institutions. All right. That's the work with testicular cancers, and it is probably the most successful result in treatment of cancers today. The next one that historically evolved was that of the ovarian cancers. And this was done primarily through the initial work of Dr. Eve Wiltshaw at the Royal Marsden Hospital in London. And she was able to show the high degree of activity of the cisplatin drug alone against the ovarian carcinomas. And she's a very charming person and a very delightful and brilliant doctor. She's in charge of the gynecologic cancer clinic at the hospital. And I recall once having a beer with her outside of the Queen's Elm, Court Inn, near the Chester Beatty Institute. And I was rather unhappy about the fact that progress was so slow in moving drugs into the clinic. And she kind of commiserated with me for a while, but then she said something interesting. She had been in clinical research and treatment of ovarian cancers for about 15 years by that time, so she's still relatively young. When she first started, they were delighted if they could even just get the fever in a patient down. And now we're talking about cures. I think that statement perked me up quite considerably, that maybe progress isn't quite so slow after all. All right, the results with ovarian carcinoma, again in a combination chemotherapy that was evolved in a number of different institutions and tested out and is continually evolving. All of these are continually being tested, improvements being made, and the results are being published, and you always see better and better results. So that as of the latest result, which was published a few months ago, for ovarian cancers, again advanced ovarian cancers where it's metastatic up into the chest cavity, the results are as follows. Complete remissions, 69%. No evidence of disease. 19% partial remissions. The tumors have regressed, but they have not yet completely disappeared. And a few percent non-responders. Out of the 69% that were in complete remission, most of them are still in remission. And according to previous studies, if you can get them into complete remission now with these kinds of therapies, now they stay in remission and they do not relapse. Usually, if they're going to relapse, they relapse early, say within the first 9 to 12 months. And now that we have many of those patients that are out to 5 years with no relapses. And so, again, the medical fraternity is now calling ovarian cancer a curable cancer. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's going to be cured by it, but apparently a significant fraction and an increasing fraction with time. The third story I'd like to tell you a little bit about is one type of lung cancer, since Dave raised the issue of the smoking business. There are four major types of lung cancers, and the worst one is called oat cell cancer of the lung, because it was the fastest killer. It turns out that that one particular cancer is the most drug sensitive, and there are a number of drugs which are active against it. And now you start to mix the drugs in combinations. And what happens? Well, in one test that was done by Dr. Wittes at Sloan Kettering, they took 38 patients with advanced terminal oat cell cancer of the lung, and they treated them with a combination of two drugs, the cisplatin and VP16, another new drug, both of which had shown activity by themselves, but together it would be expected they would get synergism, and indeed it did. Out of those 38 patients, 17 went into complete remission, 17 into partial remission, and only 4, no response at all. Out of the 17 that went into complete remission, about 60% of them are still alive 5 years later. They considered those patients cured. But in the meantime, they've made a modification of the therapy. They've added another type of combination, and they alternate the one I told you with this new type called CAV. It's a combination of Cytoxan, Adriamycin, and Vinblastine. So they alternate the cisplatin VP16 once a month, and then the second month they give the CAV, and then back to cisplatin, and they keep alternating. With this regimen, they now are able to get well over 80% into complete remission. And they're starting to move up in towards the 90% in some of the cases now. So we have then good reason to believe, and the doctor Wittes has now specified that he considers oat cell a curable cancer. And so what we have then are the stories for three particular types of cancer which have been moved from the non-curable to the curable column through the use of the cisplatin drug plus other new drugs that we now have in the stable in the medical profession. These are probably the outstanding examples, but I want to point out that we're starting to move in early days in the same way with a number of other cancers. Head and neck cancers, where cisplatin now has produced a number of patients in complete remission and is now affecting about 80% of the patients that are treated in a positive way. Bladder cancers, it is the best, most active drug by itself, but we still have not yet gotten an improvement by going into a combination chemotherapy. But many places are now working on this. There's a very large bladder cancer project going under the stimulation of the Cancer Institute to try to develop a combination using cisplatin and others to get improved results in bladder cancers. And more interesting recently is prostate cancer, because there we're able to get all of the soft tissue where the cancer is growing completely clean of cancers by a combination of platinum and adriamycin. And the bone metastases, which usually occurs very early on and therefore before most of the patients become aware they have the cancer, usually are not affected by the drugs, but radiation can handle that to a reasonable degree. But there's something much more interesting that has emerged also. When prostate cancer metastasizes to the bone, it becomes extremely painful. And the pain is so severe that even opiates can't handle it. However, for some unknown reason, but now being investigated, when they start the treatment with the platinum drug, the pain disappears. And despite the fact that in the early days there was a very heavy penalty the patients paid for taking the platinum, which I'll discuss in a moment, they looked forward to the platinum therapy because they did not want the pain to come back. And so this has turned out to be true of a number of other cancers as well, where there's severe pains, that it can be relieved by the chemotherapy treatment. And so that's an unknown mechanism that's causing it, and it is being studied. Now, there are some cancers, however, where the results are not quite as exciting as one would like, but they're starting to move up towards them even at an earlier stage. There are two childhood cancers, osteogenic sarcoma and neuroblastomas, and these are becoming quite sensitive to combinations with the platinum drug. Indeed, there was one report about a year ago where after surgery, where they used the platinum drug for the treatment of the remaining cancers, they had 10 out of 10 patients and went into complete remission and are remaining in remission up to the present. So that it looks quite active against this particular type of cancer, and this second one for children as well. Cervical and uterine cancers are also beginning to respond quite nicely, and new therapies are beginning to emerge on that, and we see new reports almost every month of activity against these. Breast cancer apparently is not that terribly exciting at the present stage when you give the drug in the standard way by putting it into the intravenous drip line. However, there is a new method of treatment which is being studied at MD Anderson Hospital, where they're suggesting that what you want is to really get a high concentration of the drug in a local region where you have a large tumor. And you will make that tumor mass go away and reduce the tumor burden in the patient, and perhaps the immune system of the host can take care of the rest of it. Well, they started to do this work on malignant melanomas. And that is another tumor that is now beginning to respond very actively to the cisplatin drug alone. And now we're going to start moving towards combinations in that treatment too. But what they do is they give the drug intra-arterially. That is, they find an artery that is just coming into the organ where the cancer is growing, and they put the drug into that artery. And when they do that, the malignant melanomas are responding very, very nicely, but then so are breast cancers. They're getting very lovely results on heavily pretreated patients with breast cancer using the intra-arterial technique. This is all very early days for this kind of work. The reports are just coming out now. Probably it'll be about another year or two before we have a good evaluation of the system. But it does look quite promising. Meanwhile, a number of other cancers have been added to the active list. That is where the cisplatin drug has a high degree of activity. Adrenal cancers, which are very rare but very dangerous. They usually are deadly within a short period of time. Hodgkin's disease, where patients have been treated by the standard therapy and have failed, are now responding, and a number of them have been put into complete remission with the platinum drug. And so on and so forth. I just don't want to simply list all of the cancers that are being involved. But obviously, it's turning out that in humans as well as in animals, as was predicted from the animal studies, we have here active combinations with a broad spectrum of activity. Not just one or two types of cancers, but apparently most of the major solid cancers are now responding. In the past, the only success we've had in cancer has been the treatment of leukemias or lymphomas, the so-called disseminated cancers, the blood cancers. Now we can treat solid cancers, and after all, solid cancers make up 92% of the total number of cancers that people get. So hard metastatic cancers are now treatable, some of them curable, and the rest are beginning to move in that direction. I think then you can see why I'm so optimistic about the prognosis for the future with regard to the chemotherapy of cancers. However, I'd like to point out that we fail in a certain number of cases, and even these cases are interesting. This is an old slide. I just don't bother to keep up to date with the cancer responses. We fail on colon cancer. I must split this off because we're now getting some successes in rectal cancers. But colon is a definite failure. And it's unfortunate because there is no good therapy for colon cancers. Stomach was considered to be a failure, and unfortunately we had developed a lovely theory as to why we should fail in the stomach and in the colon. And then a doctor in Spain came up with a test result which she reported in Brussels last October, where she had 10 patients and with advanced metastatic stomach carcinoma, failed on all previous therapies, responded beautifully to the cisplatin. Five of them went into remission and two of them into complete remission. That's just with the single drug alone. So this is now questionable. I'd like to see that result verified in another clinic before I take it too seriously. I do like that theory. The basic idea is that the colon and stomach have something unique which blocks the cisplatin drug from acting. Remember I showed you those two chlorides on it? Well, they have to come off in order for the drug to act on the cells. And if there's high chloride in the cells, it doesn't come off. And colon and stomach are the two highest chloride-containing cells in the body. So here we have a drug which, if you follow the alimentary canal down the body, is very active in head and neck cancers, in the larynx, pharynx, and esophagus, stops dead at the stomach, according to previous tests, doesn't work in the colon, both of which have this high chloride, and then starts to work again in the rectum, where again it goes down to low chloride. So we begin to see some reason why it should fail, and that tells us what to do. We must devise a modification which will still be able to become an active drug in the presence of high chloride. We now have a few such drugs in our laboratory and some other places, and they're undergoing early stage animal testing at the present time. So here at least the failures have taught us something. The other failure, of course, is the brain, but as I mentioned to you earlier, there are beginning to be some successes with some of the brain cancers, and these are indeed promising, but I'm not terribly enthusiastic. We are still looking for drugs which will penetrate the blood-brain barrier to be able to treat both the tumors which originate in the brain and those which are metastasized to the brain. And so this is the kind of work that's going on around the world now. The drug is available in the United States and in many foreign countries, and the clinical studies are underway, sponsored by international organizations all through Europe and America, and particularly by the National Cancer Institute. And they're now beginning to look at second generation platinum drugs, which in animal studies appear to be better than the first one. And these are now moving up towards human clinical trials. And one of them is already on trial in Paris. And about four others are now going on clinical trials in the United States. And we would hope that some of these will show improved responses and diminished toxicities. Now, what are the toxicities? After all, generally, whenever you take a drug, you pay a penalty. Most of them are rather moderate penalties, otherwise you wouldn't take the drug. The penalty you pay was the renal toxicity, the kidney damage I mentioned, but we found ways to obviate that. So it's no longer a problem in the treatment. However, there's one other toxicity that's caused by the platinum drug, and that's nausea and vomiting. And I take no pride in saying that the platinum drug is probably the most nauseating drug ever discovered. And a lot of patients who were successfully being treated with the platinum drug refused further therapy, facing death as the alternative because of the severe nausea and vomiting. Something had to be done about that aspect of the drug, and something was done. It was discovered again quite by accident. 100% of the patients in the early days were throwing their guts up right after the administration of the drug for a period of up to 24 hours or so. A young man, by the way, this is a somewhat apocryphal story because I've heard it from both the Sloan Kettering Institute and the same story from the Sidney Farber Institute in Boston. But nevertheless, I pass it on because it's interesting. A young man was being treated for testicular cancer with the cisplatin drug. And the doctor set him up in the room in the hospital and then left him. And he expected to come back a few hours later and find the fellow in the bathroom throwing up his guts. Instead, as he walked down the hall, there was the kid coming towards him whistling. And the doctor stopped him and said, "Didn't you take the platinum therapy?" And the kid said, "Yes." Well, the doctor's curiosity became piqued because 100% of the patients are nauseous afterwards. And he began to query the kid, and it eventually came out that he was doing something that he wasn't supposed to be doing. He was smoking marijuana. And this started the study of the use of marijuana in the amelioration of the nausea and vomiting from cancer chemotherapy. This was Dr. Salen at The Sydney Farber Institute was the first one to institute the studies. But, of course, marijuana is interdicted by the FDA, and therefore rules have to change, and the government has to relax its rules a bit to allow it to be used for medical purposes, and they're god-awful slow in doing so. And so while this is going on, and patients are somewhat illegally being given marijuana by the doctors, we've had to find some alternate methods that are acceptable today of drugs that are presently available to treat the nausea and vomiting. The earlier drugs, Compazine-type drugs, did not seem to have much of an effect. Fortunately, within this last year, three other techniques have become available, all of which have tested out very nicely, and they just about remove all of the nausea and vomiting. The best of the combinations is a Valium tablet, 10 milligrams, the day before the treatment, and a new drug called Toracan, which is an anti-emetic agent. And the combination of those two has just about removed the nausea and vomiting to the vanishing point. And so we finally are able to stop worrying about that. And now that we have finally successfully discovered ways of getting around the side effects of the platinum drug, that are the two dominant ones that were distasteful to the patients, the kidney toxicity and the nausea and vomiting, up comes somebody with a new modification of a platinum drug, which in animal tests does not show either kidney toxicity or nausea and vomiting as side effects. But what other side effects it will produce, we don't know yet. But there, at least there's that hope that if we needed to go that way, it is available. And so what I want to point out to you is that the results at the present time, I think, provide a fairly secure basis for optimism. Not guarded anymore, but just sheer optimism. The improvement in the therapies are growing at an exponential rate at the present time. The new therapies, the better results, are coming along all the time. That does not mean that we still do not have a severe problem. We do. We have an awful lot of different cancers that are still untreatable, but we are working on them, and the chances of success are quite significantly improved. After all, it's an astonishing thing if you can give a drug to a patient and then watch in the lung pictures a mass of tumor tissue on the order of pounds disappear without any side effects that are unacceptable to the patient. That's an astonishing thing. Why aren't we drastically disturbing the normal functions of the body? And obviously we're not. We're able to do that with one tumor. We're now able to do it with about four tumors, five tumors, six tumors. We can just extend this on with additional work. It was that first breakthrough of the testicular cancers which gave us the basis and the reasons for wanting to push forward with this degree of optimism. And I think we will succeed with the others. But meanwhile, we have that core question of chemotherapy. Why are you selectively able to destroy cancer cells without hitting normal cells? Now, there are a number of arguments that could be made, and the sort of hand-waving type arguments. For example, if the drug was taken up selectively by the tumor tissue and it accumulated large amounts, that it would kill it, whereas normal cells would not accumulate that amount and therefore tolerate it. Well, that's not true. We've measured the amounts accumulated in tumors, and there's no more than are in the normal organs of the body. In fact, there's a lot more in some of the organs of the body which show no effects. So you can't use that as an argument. Then there was another argument, well, tumor cells are the faster growing cells, and therefore they're the more rapidly damaged by the drug. It's not true, because there are many tumors that grow much slower than some of the normal cells of the body which are not affected by the drug. So that sort of a hand-waving argument had to be thrown out. We come down to a very complex point, but really, in essence, a simple point as well. We've suggested a specific hypothesis as to how the drug is able to selectively destroy cancer cells, and what it is emerged from work done by our brethren who work the other side of the street, namely those who are interested in what cause cancers. And most of the work that's been done with chemicals which cause cancers have suggested that cancers arise in cells when they're treated with these kinds of chemicals which do certain kinds of damage to the DNA, when those cells' ability to repair that damage is impaired itself. That is, it's deficient in its ability to repair. All of our cells have an entire menagerie of repair systems, which look up and down like policemen along the DNA. When they find something's wrong, they chop it out, remove it, replace the portion that was chopped out, and therefore the DNA is not affected in any way. These are the repair processes, and all our cells have them. However, if some cells should miss one particular type of repair process, one enzyme or protein that's needed to do that particular repair, and it's exposed to these chemicals, it will become a cancer cell. How, we don't know, but it will. What we found was that the platinum drug affects just exactly that kind of place on the DNA. It hits the DNA in the same place where those cells that became cancer cells are unable to repair. And so what we suggested was this, that if you inject the platinum drug into the patient, it goes to all of the cells of the body. It goes to the DNA in all of the cells in the body, and it makes damage to all of the cells in the body. However, the normal cells repair that damage very quickly, before the cell has a chance to divide. Some cells, the cancer cells, are cancer cells because they cannot repair that damage, and therefore the damage remains. And they build up this burden of damage to the DNA of the cell until it can no longer survive, and it kills the cell. That's a very simple-minded picture of how we cause cancers and how we cure cancers. I mean, there are a lot of parts that are still not filled in, but those are the major lines of argument. But very simple-minded. But we have a test that can tell us whether it's true or not. And we've started preliminary testing in our laboratory. And the very earliest tests only, I can report, suggest that we have evidence to support that simplistic idea. Now, let me conclude then by bringing back to your mind an favorite expression of Albert Einstein. He stated, loosely translated, following, that nature is subtle, but it is not devious. Well, earlier on, I suggested with the resistentialism argument that nature may indeed be devious. Well, now I'm suggesting that nature might not even be subtle. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions. Yes.
What about the interferon? Would that work on the same principle as this, or are we dealing with immunity?
Well, the basic argument for interferon is that it would stimulate the immune system to attack the tumor cells. And indeed, there is good evidence to suggest that the cisplatin does something slightly different, but it does still involve the immune system. It makes the tumor cells more available to attack by the immune system. So it's very likely that a combination of interferon and cisplatin might, or a number of other drugs that work this way, might indeed be a significant improvement. And in fact, it's known that if you inject a certain chemical called poly-C, it stimulates interferon in the animals. And they have tested that as against the tumors. It's very weak. They take the platinum drug, they get a certain response. They add the two together, they get a much enhanced response. So it suggests that indeed that might be the case. However, interferon is not the panacea that people have been led to believe, and I'd like to disabuse some of the notions that you may have that it's going to cure cancers. It's not. It's an excellent antiviral compound. It's our first line of immunologic defense against viral diseases. The activity against cancer probably only arises from the stimulation of the immune system, something that we can do with other techniques as well, by the way. Now, it has been tested now in preliminary tests, and those test results are not very optimistic. It has failed to produce any responses in the patients in some classes of cancers, and I think in breast cancer it is showing a small amount of response. But our drugs we now have way, way better than interferon. So the fact that the publicity splurge has occurred should not bring out in your minds a false image that as soon as we get interferon, we don't have to worry about cancer anymore. That's not true. Just take it with a grain of salt. Yes?
In treatment of lung cancer, what determines whether chemotherapy or radiation therapy is the best course? Is that a matter of preference by a particular clinic you would be going to, a doctor?
You've just about answered your own question correctly, I think. It is a matter of the clinic's experience. There are certain places which historically evolve from radiation therapy units, and therefore they tend to emphasize radiation therapy, and then they might be willing to add chemotherapy on top of that. And in fact, at Roswell Park, for example, they are treating the other major types of lung cancers with a high degree of success, using rather heroic measures of cisplatin in combination with other drugs in combination with radiotherapy. And so those two together seem to be, chemotherapy and radiation therapy, seem to be working out quite nicely. Oh, most definitely, sure. And the other way around, where chemotherapy wasn't successful and radiation therapy worked. Yes?
Is cancer actually increased in the population over the years? Are we doing something different? Drinking water different?
No, I think there's another slightly more subtle reason, if I may present it to you. Yes, it is true. There has been, over the past 25 years, a very small percentage increase in the total number of cancers in America. That's not generally true around the world, but in America it's clearly been shown. Now, you question why this should be the case. Are we, as you say, being exposed to more cancer-causing agents? I think that's not the answer. I think the answer is that we are just living longer. And since cancer is a disease of elderly, predominantly, it increases very rapidly as a function of age, that living longer and not dying of other competing causes has given us the greater ability to be exposed to the cancer and to die. So I think this is the reason why it's showing up as a slight increase in statistics.
Would there be any way to get you mentioned platinum, would be any way to get this out of groundwater naturally?
No. Platinum is a heavy metal, and most of the surface of the earth are composed of light elements. The amount of platinum in the ground is about one part per billion.
How do you make that synthetically then?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We mine, well, not me, but they mine platinum, and then they do the chemistry on the platinum metal, after they've purified it so that it's very highly purified, 99.99%. Well, it occurs either as a metal in some places or as a sulfide in other places. There's plenty of platinum around. Yes?
If you had cancer, what would be the place you'd go to?
It would depend upon the cancer. That's one of the interesting things I've found and learned, in fact, and recommend to most people, that depending upon the cancer type, different institutions have different success rates. That is, one place may specialize in a certain kind of cancer. They see a lot of it, and they've got a lot of experience, and therefore they will give you better potentials for success in that place. So, for example, I think we're all aware of the fact that St. Jude's Hospital is the place that gets the best results with childhood leukemias. Are you aware that Stanford is the best place to go if you have lymphomas? Are you aware that if you have colon cancer, the best place to go is the Mayo Clinic? Lung cancer, probably either the Mayo Clinic or Sloan Kettering Institute, or Roswell Park. Those are the three major places I would consider for lung cancers. So it depends upon the type, and it certainly varies from place to place. Now, that does not mean that you cannot get the optimal therapy from a local oncologist, because they are all specialists in the treatment of cancer. They are all aware of the latest therapies, and when they're convinced that these are indeed successful therapies, they do give them to the patients, their own patients. But I would suggest that anybody with cancer who is treated by a surgeon or by an X-ray radiologist is probably putting their life in danger. That's a rather strong statement to make, but I do stand by that statement, that you should be treated by an oncologist trained in that as a subspecialty. They're the ones who know the best things to do.
You mean for breast cancer?
I certainly do.
There is no need for
No, I didn't say that. They may recommend surgery to you. And that, of course, varies, and this is quite a significant argument going on in breast cancer as to whether you just do a lumpectomy or you do a mastectomy and whether a radical is called for. That has not been resolved yet, and there's still controversy about it. But your clinician, your oncologist, will be able to tell you, one, that you have it, and two, what to do about it, and suggest where it's to be done. If surgery is required, he'll be able to get the surgeon to help you. But I think it should be treated primarily by an oncologist as the primary medical doctor. Question?
Is there a study in the country going on or anything that would give us an incident of high cancer in certain areas? Or the other day I on the TV I heard that there was between 30 and 50,000 chemical dumps in the United States. And is there any relation between a study, say, of lung cancer and tumor cancers and whatever in certain areas throughout the country that would have a little higher incidence than other areas?
Yes, there certainly is. But I must make you aware of a very severe problem to that simplistic statement. And that is that you will find some areas where one type of cancer predominates more than the national average. And you may even ascribe it to a specific pollutant or environmental hazard that's there. But what you find, and they don't report, is that in that same place, other types of cancers are appearing less than are appearing in the rest of the country. What appears to be the case is that there is a, I don't want to put it, well, I'll say it as I feel, that there is a cancer susceptible group in the population. Say about 25% of the people are susceptible, will come down with cancers. Okay? Now, which cancer they come down with may be an accident of time and space, where they're at and what they're breathing, what they're eating, whether they're smoking or not. Okay? And they'll come down with the cancer. All right. If one type of cancer starts to increase, then since there's that limited number that are available to get cancers, some other types must give up and go down. For example, the Cancer Institute put out a report about 2 years ago that the incidence of stomach cancer in America is decreasing rapidly, and we don't know why. Well, the explanation is very simple. The incidence of intestinal cancer is increasing rapidly, and those two are related to each other inversely, with a very high correlation. So if one goes up, the other one must come down. And that's why. It's not that we're doing something to decrease the stomach cancer rate. We're not. But we are doing something to increase the colon cancer rate. And therefore, it must drop the other. So, yes, chemical dumps and other places will cause an increased incidence of a given type of cancer. But in the total population, only certain numbers of people will come down with those cancers. And we've just about saturated that number now. It's about 25%. And if one goes up, another one must come down to compensate.
Is genetic research being done on susceptibility?
Yes. Actually, there are cancers which are known to be inherited along Mendelian lines. But these are rare types of cancers like retinoblastoma and some kidney cancers. And there are, that's the clearest case where genetics determines whether you're in the cancer susceptible group. Then there are familial predispositions to cancer, where they say a higher incidence of breast cancer in the women of a given family, and therefore that indicates, again, a genetic component. But then there are other cases of where rare cancer individuals come down with cancers where most of the other people die of heart disease in the family. So it's very difficult to clearly show in those latter cases, and those are the majority of the cases, that there is any genetic influence, unless you go in and look what the genetic effect is doing. And we suspect it has something to do with this repair mechanism that I spoke about earlier, that deficiencies in repair enzymes, and there are a whole slew of them, so it's a multi-gene process, will control it. And that would be hard to pull out by the classic genetic type of experiments. Yes?
What year did you find this metal?
We discovered the anti-tumor activity in 1969. And they told me in 1970 that it would take about 10 years to go from the clinical observation to, from the laboratory observation to the clinic. And I just didn't believe it. Why the hell should it take 10 years to bring a drug up for treatment of cancer? I mean, it's not as though it's a new pill that we're suggesting where you want to be careful whom you give it to. These people are dying, and they're going to die if you don't give them something. It took exactly 10 years to get the FDA to finally approve it, which was last year. Yes?
How do you go about
it? Oh. I think it's a total fraud. Earlier on, when in the days when there were no good therapies for cancer, for solid cancers, certainly if you want to take Laetril, go ahead and do it. I mean, it won't do you any good, but it probably won't do you any harm, despite the fact that they're saying people are dying of cyanide poisoning. I think that's a scare tactic. But at the present time, when we have therapies that work, to consider using Laetril, which does not work, I think is criminal. I think it's stupid on the part of the individual who takes it, and it's criminal on the part of those who push it. And that's what's the status today. We do have drugs which do work. And therefore, stay with the drugs which work. Be sure. It's your life which is at stake. Don't gamble it. And Laetril is worse than a gamble, because the table is stacked completely against you. That just doesn't work. Question back there.
Are there any preventative steps that we can take in our daily lives?
Oh, that is a very hard question to answer. Let me tell you why. Suppose I'm right about this cancer-susceptible group. The question is would you want to know whether you are in that cancer-susceptible group? I mean, we can develop perhaps a test which will tell you whether you are or not. Would you want to know? Most people probably would not want to know. There are other social ramifications. Should you tell your boss if you're going to be exposed in an environment where there are carcinogens present? Obviously, if you are in the cancer-susceptible group, you should stay away from a carcinogen-loaded atmosphere. That might be true in certain chemical plants or handling certain chemicals or radiations. Would a person hire you if he knew you were in the cancer-susceptible group? He might not. So it's a loaded question in that respect. Other than that, I would just suggest leading a normal life and just pray to God that we find cures for the other cancers as well. That's about the only thing I can suggest. If you start to worry about every type of carcinogen which has been mentioned in the press over the past 15 to 20 years, your life will be so constricted that it wouldn't be worth living. It really wouldn't. All right, now in smoking, I smoke. But I smoke a low-tar nicotine cigarette, and I manage to get sufficient satisfaction from that. There are possibilities we can eliminate the gross carcinogens from the environment. But there are some subtle ones that we're not aware of, and I wouldn't even start to worry about. For example, the chloromethane in the drinking water. I wouldn't worry about that sort of thing, because there's no solid evidence in humans that it has any impact. It may do so in animals, but not in humans. The controversy over saccharin, for example. I think that's a little bit overblown right now, because there is no evidence, and even in the reviews that are occurring, it's so ambiguous that there's no case that can be made for stopping saccharin use on the basis of its carcinogenicity. And in fact, there was a study done of bladder cancer patients, and they found that the distribution between sugar and saccharin users was the same in them as in other types of patients that they studied. And yet saccharin is of some value with regard to people who have diabetes, and therefore I wouldn't give it up for anything on the basis of this scare possibility. And the nitrates in the meats, which prevent botulism. There's certainly every good reason to want to keep the nitrates until it's absolutely clear that we don't that it is a clear and present danger. And that's by no means established for the nitrates. In fact, it's becoming more and more ambiguous as time goes on. The earlier evidence, which looked so positive, has gotten less and less positive as we've repeated the studies. So there's no way, really, that you can avoid it. There is a natural cancer rate that occurs even before the pre-industrial civilization, because there have been statistics kept in cities like London starting about 100 and some odd years ago on cancer rates. And that has not, when you compensate for the age of the longer-lived people that we have at the present time, when you put that compensation in, there has been no increase in the amount of cancer in London in over 100 years. And yet certainly that was before the coal explosion in London. And so obviously there is a tremendous increase in what we'd normally call carcinogens in the environment in London, and yet there's been no increase in the cancer rate if you correct for the age differences. So just play it cool is the best I can suggest.
I just have a question that sure. You would clarify for me, and I lost you. Well, when you were talking about these tumor cells and that you felt that they were bipolar, and then I think you had set up electrodes. Now, I mean, as far as the dichlorodiamine platinum number 2, I mean, was this, I mean, did you get this salt or this compound, rather, from one of the electrodes?
Exactly.
And what was your solution that you had?
Well, it was what we call a chemically defined media, that is a mixture of certain salts and glucose that the bacteria were growing in. One of the salts was ammonium chloride. Mm-hmm. That was the crucial salt. And in the presence of the electrode material, the platinum, the ammonium chloride, and the electric field, that generated cisplatin.
And this medium then showed itself that it prevented your coli from dividing. So I mean that this was really your basis for this conclusion, that you could prevent this mitosis because your coli were not dividing.
No, not quite, because I didn't make it quite clear enough that coli do not show these mitotic figures. We were only using that as a test system to test the apparatus out.
Mm-hmm.
But what we were able to show was that it indeed did stop cell division in E. coli.
I see.
And cause these giant filaments to form.
I see.
And what we found is that the effects in mammalian cells are somewhat different. Mm-hmm. But sometimes we still get giant cells forming in mammalian cells with cisplatin.
Thank you.
But it's a slightly different effect.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, the rest of what you said is quite correct. You did get it.
Yeah, well, I just didn't know where it came from.
Okay. Yes?
How about immunity to cancer? Is there any research going on?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is a very highly active field of research at the present time. It seems obvious from most of the chemotherapy work that we have seen that the immune system does play a significant role. And included in certainly in animal tests of the cisplatin, we can see this quite clearly, because if we knock out the immune system of an animal, we get a much decreased effect of the cisplatin on treating a tumor. And so the two are, it's both important to do something to the cell and also to have the immune system available to attack the tumor cell. And in fact, there's a theory of what they call immune surveillance put out some years ago, which suggests that the body has policemen. In addition to the cells' policemen that monitor the DNA, the body has policing cells, which, when they see a cancer cell, destroy it. And they're continuously running through the entire body. And that it's only when something goes wrong with this immune surveillance mechanism that the cells can grow up into a cancer. The tumor cells can grow up into a cancer. So that seems to be, the evidence is rather mixed with regard to that specific approach, but apparently the immune system is important. And work on enhancing its effect and using immune stimulants is going on, but nothing of great success has emerged yet. But perhaps maybe 10 years from now, they may make a very significant contribution. Yeah. I'll tell you something. About 5 years ago, I was at an American Cancer Society Science Writers Seminar, you know, their local spring thing before they start to hand out envelopes to everybody to put money into, to get publicity on what they're, what's going on in cancer. And a psychiatrist from Stanford, working with an oncologist, did a study of cancer patients, trying to determine what kind of personalities they had compared to normal patients. Were there any differences in the personality types? And indeed, he did find one, that the cancer patients appeared to have a slightly different personality on average than the rest of the non-cancer patients in the hospitals. And therefore, this suggested that your ability to handle the environment and your circumstances may have some impact upon the cancer. Well, it was obvious to the reporters there that this was a very dangerous question and ought to be clarified. And so what they did was to ask all of us that were up on the podium to give our opinion of this guy's work. That's almost unheard of, but I think it was correct for the reporters to do so, because if you carry it to its extreme, you're telling a mother of a leukemia patient that you caused the leukemia in the patient, because you determined what the personality is of the individual by your behavior pattern. And therefore, it enhanced the probability of that child coming down with leukemia. That's a terrible thing to say. I don't think I'd be happy having that out in the literature at all. And fortunately, they did play it very carefully, and it never did appear in that blatant a way. And there are still papers occasionally coming out of personality types that are more, show an increased predisposition to cancer. But I suspect that there's a little bit of the statistical shenanigans going on in that, and I'm not terribly happy with it. I was trying to remember what, while I was talking, which was the personality type. And I think it was the gray flannel suit was the personification of the personality type that would be showing an enhanced, the rigid, highly moralistic, highly driven, activated, motivated type of individual. If there are any psychologists here, please forgive me. But I think that's what they were describing as the type that showed up an enhanced incidence of cancers. Well, you know, happy people die too. Well, thank you very much for having me.
But as far as your DNA and genes, etc., I mean, are they only present in the germplasm cells?
No. Every cell of your body.
Every
has
single cell.
The same amount of DNA information.
Every single cell. I thought the somatic cells and the germplasm.
Right.
I thought it was just the germplasm.
No, but they all. The germplasm is able to have a double set of it.
I see. It has a double set.
I'm sorry. The half set. The germplasm has a half set, and then when you mix the germplasm from the mother and the father, you get a complete set.
I see.
And then every cell of the rest of your body has a complete set from that point on.
I see.
Then in some of those cells that are set aside to become germplasm, there's haploid instead of diploid amounts of DNA. It's half the amount.
Half the amount. So
right.
The germplasm is half the
half
amount.
Half the amount of the normal cells.
And the others have the double. Okay,
right.
Well, thanks a lot.
Excellent. All right, thank you very much.
Oh, good.
I really enjoyed this very much. I have one other question.
Yeah.
Do you ever give speeches out to, like, organizations or this type of thing along the same nature?
Yeah, but I can't.
Can you hold away? Stay with me now, okay?
The number of invitations.
Right, I understand.
To get to the honors at times.
Okay. Very good.
So I'm kind of cutting back on
it. Well, I feel privileged. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that.